From the studios of KUSP in Santa Cruz, California, I'm Gary Shapiro, and this is From the Bookshelf. My guest this week is William Stadium. He's an author, a screenwriter, and a chronicler of our times. His work has appeared almost everywhere, and you've seen him on your TV, and now here he is on From the Bookshelf. His latest book is Jet Set: The People, the Planes, the Glamour, and the Romance in Aviation's Glory Years. William Stadium, welcome to From the Bookshelf.
It's nice to be here, Gary.
I loved your book. It was a lot of fun.
I had a great time writing it. What could be more fun than traveling the routes that I sort of fantasized about as a kid and really, you know, sort of got to live in a past that will never be equaled in the present the way the airlines are going today.
No, I just came back from New York, and the era of pleasant travel is really long gone.
Oh, it's really tragic. I was just in Europe in June, and I was flying the new Airbus 380, and it was really an example of the 1% and the 99%. I thought it was going to be a high-tech plane. It would be more comfortable, at least. No, it's like a flying cattle car, and they've just jammed more and more people in the upper deck and lower deck, and the stewardesses and the hosts were saying, it's nice in the very cone in the front of the plane. It's so bumpy in the back because of the double-decker nature that, you know, you feel like you need several trips to the dentist to replace fillings by the time you land.
That's terrible. Well,
But in Pan Am, in the good old days, I remember taking a few of those flights, and they were unbelievable. I mean, economy was like luxury. It was big seats.
I used to, you know, when I got on a plane, I would always, well, first thing I would do is I'd try to get on before anybody else and claim the armrest, you know, before the other person got on. But I always would look at the person next to me and think, do I want to just look straight ahead and ignore them, or do I want to be all chatty with them in hopes of getting some of their food? Because I loved airline food. I thought airline food was like the greatest.
It was. It was good. Pan Am was catered by Maxim's of Paris. And Air France was catered by La Tour d'Argent. So you couldn't go too far wrong. And what they were really serving in those days was stuff that even air kitchens couldn't ruin. It was like foie gras and caviar and smoked salmon. I mean, this was, you know, and the best hams and pâtés and stuff. So you couldn't mess it up. It was so good. And then wonderful chocolates. And even what they cooked was great, too. They'd somehow make a beautiful roast or something like, and they served it on the finest china and silverware and crystal. Boy, it was different and cheap.
And the people who served it were attractive and pleasant.
Oh God, yes. You know, it was very sexist because, I mean, that was a big thing in the 70s or 80s when the stewardesses union said you can't. It used to be they would put people out to pasture when they ceased being young and beautiful.
Right.
And
Carol, you know, fly me.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, that was, you know, I write about it in Jet Set. It was, you know, Mary Wells Lawrence, who was a, you know, sort of the most powerful woman in American advertising, but she created probably the most sexist air campaign, you know, for Braniff. They called it the Air Strip, and the stewardesses would start in New York wearing an elaborate Pucci cape and everything in a coat, and by the time they reached the destination, usually in Mexico or South America, they were half naked. They were in a string bikini. And who didn't want to fly that plane?
Yeah.
Or at least what man didn't want to fly that plane? So it did very well for the business traveler.
The era,
but it was very sexist. I mean, women, you know, today, I mean, this is what sort of ushered in feminism because people were getting angry at this. But you know, for the guys, it was nice while it lasted.
Well, I can see why they objected to hot pants and all those things, even though I've happened to like them. But, you know, it just seems like that's not the only thing that's gone. I mean, pretty much everything is gone.
Everything is gone. You know, look, the 60s, you know, at least the beginning of the 60s, and it sort of carried through until the end. The era of that plane, the 707, and its rival, the DC-8, which by Pan Am's being first with the 707, it stole the DC-8's thunder. It was a very similar jet plane, but somehow the fantasy plane was the 707. But by the time Juan Trippe, the head of Pan Am, and Bill Allen, the head of Boeing, said, we're making so much money, the 707 is too small. They decided to kick it up a notch to the 747. And that's what ruined, I mean, then everything went wrong, because then America went wrong with, you know, Vietnam, with the civil rights, with the assassinations, and the world went wrong with terrorism and Black September and everything. And so those big 707s were flying, 747s were flying empty if they weren't being blown up for a decade.
Yeah.
And this excess capacity and desperation of the airlines then led to deregulation, and just everything went into a spiral, and Pan Am didn't make it, TWA didn't make it, Eastern, all the airlines of our youth are gone. I mean, they're...
And I know, I just never in a million years thought that there wouldn't be a TWA, a Pan Am, you know...
No, they were just like Coca-Cola. Imagine, is Coca-Cola gone?
Right.
They were as American as Coca-Cola and Marilyn Monroe and apple pie, and now gone.
The Pan Am building is there, but Pan Am is not there.
But they don't even call it the Pan Am building anymore. I think it's Metropolitan Life now.
Yeah.
Nothing. It's all gone.
It also seems that 9/11, which, I mean, I understand that airplanes were, you know, involved, and that was a terrible thing. But as a result of 9/11, now they can't give you a pillow.
They can't do anything. That was a good excuse for them to cut back on every service. Although, I noticed on recent flights I've taken, on the, at least the foreign carriers, you do get sort of metal knives and forks now, as opposed to plastic.
The spork.
so they somehow that's been overlooked.
Huh.
But no, I mean, it's just an ordeal flying, and I don't know how people can stand it, yet the planes are full.
Yeah.
And I guess they're full because the skies are empty. I mean, they're consolidating, so they make sure they are not flying unless they're flying with a full load.
Right. So that, often you can't get the exact route that you wanted, like you used to.
No, they've
cut
everything back. Yeah. The airlines have cut. I mean, they're pretty smart with these computers. They figured out, you know, the whole business angle on it. But the customers just forget it. And so, what used to be first class in the 70s and the 60s is now private jet if you want to fly like that.
Right.
Even the front of the planes today. I went on this flight. I took British Airways over to Europe in June, and you know, the business class, which I think they call it upper class or whatever. No, that's Virgin. The World Traveler, or whatever they call the business class in British. It looks like a morgue. I mean, you have, you know, they're flatbed seats, but, you know, you know your face is at somebody else's feet. Some people face one direction, some face the other. And it really looks like a complete morgue with a bunch of slabs. And there's nothing glamorous about it.
How pleasant.
It's just a place to take your Ambien, knock yourself out, and try to sleep and not, you know, pretend it's not happening until you get there.
So that's why it's so wonderful to read this book, Jet Set, The People, The Planes, The Glamour, and The Romance in Aviation's Glory Years, with my guest, William Stadium. The wonderful era that you write about, the era of James Bond and the Rat Pack, and I guess you're familiar with the Rat Pack too, because you also wrote a book about Frank Sinatra. You co-wrote a book with George Jacobs.
Another fun book to have done, Mr. S, which I did with George Jacobs, who alas just passed away a few months ago, but he was Sinatra's valet, his right-hand man for those glory years from 53 to 68, so he was the jet-set valet of all time. And Sinatra, with his song Come Fly With Me, was the sort of poster boy of the jet age before the Beatles, you know, replaced him later in the 60s. And but, you know, Sinatra really put flying on the map, even though he himself was a white-knuckle, terrified of flying person.
Hmm.
And he had George, his valet, check. He spent more time on the talking to towers around the country and around the world to make sure there was no turbulence and that was going to be the most perfect weather throughout the flight, or otherwise, you know, Sinatra wouldn't go.
Well, he wouldn't go.
He had on he and he also was incredibly and politically incorrect. He had, in addition to the jets that he would charter, he had his own private plane, first a prop and later a Learjet, but it was called the El Dago. And then when the, you know, eventually the Italian-American Defamation League leaned on him, and he changed it to the Christina, named after his daughter. So, you know, the 60s and the jet set era are really, in a way, a book. It's a book about men behaving badly, but they did what they had been conditioned to do. And only at the end of the decade did Betty Friedan and the feminists come along and sort of call them on it, and things started to change.
And it's interesting that that would affect air travel, but it really did, because, well, for all the reasons that we've talked about. One of the people that you spend some time writing about in your book is Ian Fleming. And I recently read all of the James Bond novels in order. And they're great. They're really fun.
They were fun. That's why they were John F. Kennedy's favorite books. I mean, Ian Fleming was his favorite writer, was many people's favorite writer. It was pure, sophisticated escapism.
And
very sexy.
And a lot of jet-setting around, of course, which then translated to the film.
That was one of the greatest things for Pan Am, was in the first Dr. No, is when you saw the Pan Am jet touch down, I guess, in Jamaica, in Montego Bay. What publicity that was for Pan Am. So it made everybody who watched movies then want to get up and go. And the great thing was you could afford to do it. I mean, that was also the great thing about the 60s, is that, you know, if you look at the jet as the hardware and the world as the software, the hardware was fairly expensive, but the software was free. I mean, you could have these tours, and one thing, the tour, that was just a package where you get a month of hotels around Europe and airfare for, you know, $1,000.
Yeah.
I mean, that literally, it was Europe on $5 a day, and you could live pretty well on $5 a day. And you could live like a king on $25 a day.
Right. There were the two competing travel volumes that you write about.
Exactly, and that's very fascinating. It's like two views of the world, but one was Temple Fielding, who was the sort of the guidebook writer of the 60s. I mean, he wrote this Fielding's Guide to Europe, and it was super luxury. But again, it was luxury at a price that you didn't have to be the 0.1% to afford. You could, I mean, for example, you could stay at Claridge's for 20 in London, which is the fanciest, most famous hotel, for $20 or $25 a night. You could stay at the Ritz in Paris for $20 or $25 a night. You could eat at the Tour d'Argent or Maxim's for $15. And Fielding was so entrepreneurial, he even created his own dining club where you would get coupons to eat at these restaurants and stay at these hotels, and they'd give you a royal welcome, because in those times, Americans weren't used to traveling, and they thought that the French maitre d's and concierges were snooty and would look down on them. But if you flashed the Fielding guide and membership in the Fielding Travel Club, you know, it was like showing a cross to a vampire, and they bent down and, you know, waited on you hand and foot. And then at the other end of the extreme was Arthur Frommer, who created Europe on $5 a day. And he started when he was a GI in the World War II, he wrote a guidebook to it where people would go on the base. It was post-war, on the, you know, in Germany, where to eat and where, but mostly what to see. He was much more sightseeing than Fielding. Fielding couldn't care less about sightseeing. He was about hotels, restaurant, shopping, and brothels.
Yes.
Right, about the best nightclubs in Europe, all throughout Europe, prostitution was legal, so he told you where to go. And again, the feminists today would kill him, but then everybody just bought the book. He was like the best-selling author of the 60s. These books sold millions and millions of copies.
And obviously he had to go to each brothel and make sure that it was
part of the fun of his job. Is, you know, he had to sample it. He was a hands-on guidebook writer. Frommer was more of a square, but he really created this image of Europe on $5 a day. But his place, I mean, if you look at Frommer today, they still publish these books. They don't have a price tag on it, but, you know, eventually it went up to $50 a day. And today, that $5 a day would be more like, you know, $500 a day.
Yeah.
Nothing has inflated more in the world than, you know, travel and luxury travel.
The euro has certainly...
And the euro has killed us. I mean, we can't go anywhere.
Right. It used to be you could go some places in Europe where, you know, like Belgium, where the economy was, you know, the Belgian franc was like, I don't know, it was cheap. But now...
Right. Well, look at the Greek drachma. Why should the Greek currency be worth much more than the dollar? But with the euro, it is.
Right.
So you can't even go to Greece anymore. I remember as a student going to Greece in the summer, and it was like nothing. It was like free, and nothing more.
How did Mrs. Fielding feel about Fielding's Guide to the
brothel. She was a very cultured woman. She was the one who encouraged him to be a writer. He was an ad man. He was a Don Draper, Madison Avenue guy, and she was a top New York literary agent. And, you know, she knew how unhappy he was on Madison Avenue, and she felt writing a book would set him free. Little did she know it would set him free from her to go out and party around the continent. But, you know, she was like all the women in that era, and the sort of pre-Betty Friedan people, they looked the other way. It was just the way things were then. You know, it was sort of, John Updike country and John Cheever, and adultery was tolerated, and maybe it was safer to go to prostitutes and brothels because there was no, you never see the girl again. It was a one-time thing, and it was no entangling alliances as opposed to with the,
a mistress,
neighbor's wife. Yeah. But Mrs. Fielding, they had an extremely happy marriage, and then they died within like a year of each other. You know, it's like he got sick and died, and she couldn't go on without it.
We're talking with William Stadium. His new book is called Jet Set: The People, the Planes, the Glamour, and the Romance in Aviation's Glory Years. You also wrote the screenplay that became Oliver Stone's JFK, is that right?
Yes, I did. I spent a year in New Orleans. Originally, the story was owned by, of all people, the Zucker brothers. You may have heard of them.
Airplane.
The great comedian comedy team that produced Airplane and Ruthless People and a lot of these other things. But they were fascinated with the Kennedy assassination. They were conspiracy buffs. And they acquired Jim Garrison, the New Orleans DA, who was the one highest public official that challenged the Warren Commission, and sent me down to New Orleans for a year to get his story. And it was my first screenwriting assignment, and it was really an eye-opener and extremely exciting to go to New Orleans and live the life of an assassination hound. Well, and I wrote the script, but they couldn't get it off the ground. It was too controversial. And eventually, Oliver Stone met Jim Garrison, and he said, "You have the greatest story in the world." He said, "Well, I don't own my story anymore. I sold it to the Zuckers and Stadium." And he decided that we were all part of a CIA conspiracy to suppress the story, when the truth was, Hollywood didn't want anything controversial. But Oliver Stone wasn't afraid of controversy, and hats off to him. He got the thing made. He had a lot more sort of kind of speculative conspiracy theories in his movie than we had. We tried to do, sort of just the facts, man. But in any case, I was, happy that the movie got made.
Well, I also noticed that you wrote a novel with Vincent Bugliosi. He was the prosecutor in the Manson case, and he's been a guest here on From the Bookshelf a number of times. And he wrote a book a little while ago, a few years back. It was at about a 1,500-page book that set out the case pretty conclusively that Oswald was, in fact, the lone assassin. I wonder if you ever got into the assassination with Vincent Bugliosi.
Vince is a good friend and an absolutely wonderful guy and a great writer. And we did a fun book together about the Roaring Twenties, and a true... We made it a novel, but it was a true-life murder mystery in the Jimmy Walker Prohibition era in New York City, where this beautiful woman was murdered, and the unraveling of the cover-up ended up in the resignation of the most glamorous mayor in New York history, and a change in what was controlled by Tammany Hall was probably the most corrupt. New York was more corrupt than Chicago or New Orleans, but it's cleaned up. In any case, Vince and I got into it because in doing the Garrison story, I was, became a kind of conspiracy believer. And Vince is the absolute other side, believing that, Oswald acted alone. And I still can't believe that Oswald could have been that lucky a shot to have done it alone. And I learned so much about all the other dark characters floating around the New Orleans-Dallas axis in that era, that, Vince and I are just, we beg to differ, but we do like each other, so he's a great guy.
He not only does not believe in the conspiracy, but he believes that the conspirators hurt America with their conspiracy theories.
I know. We have a different thing. I believe the, the ones who were trying to unravel the conspiracy. I mean, look, it's left versus right. Vince, who is a very liberal person, takes a very kind of establishment view of this.
Yeah,
but I could never imagine myself siding with the Warren Commission.
Well, you also spent some time in your book talking about Howard Hughes. He's an interesting character.
What a great character. If anybody was sort of the symbol, or should have been the symbol of the jet set, it was Howard Hughes, because he was not only a great aviator himself and a pioneering aviator and a fearless aviator with the Spruce Goose and stuff, but, you know, he was a billionaire, he's one of the richest men, he was one of the most glamorous men in Hollywood, a major producer, but he was more obsessed with designing Jane Russell's cantilevered bra, the movie The Outlaw, than he was in Jet Airlines. And throughout the whole Jet age, he was just getting crazier and crazier and crazier. And really, TWA missed the boat. I mean, that's Pan Am. That's how Pan Am dominated the skies, because TWA was a late starter because Howard Hughes was being too crazy. And his shareholders eventually got rid of it. And so he who should have been the poster boy of the jet age and of the jet set era was too busy being the crazy boy of that era.
Interesting. And, you know, that was quite a bra that he...
Yes, it was. It was a big Bertha. I mean, he really had... he was obsessed with... I mean, he was a ladies' man, like all the sort of people I seem to be writing about in this book. It was all about the liberation of the world, the jet. It, you know, it was a liberated time, the 60s, you know, free love, free everything, and to go into Europe, which was much less, even though it was a Catholic continent for the most part, the sexual hypocrisy was vastly different from the United States. And the United States had a lot of catching up to do. So a lot of men and young men certainly got liberated as kids, getting to go to Europe and getting to, you know, have sex way before they might have been able to. And so, it really, I think, the jet really added to the American sexual revolution of the 60s, because it got to see another part of the world where the standards were very different from ours.
So there was the pill, there was Elvis Presley, there was Masters and Johnson, and there was the jet set.
And the jet.
Yeah. You also talk about the famous Profumo scandal. I don't know if a lot of people know about that, but you spend some time writing about it in the book.
That's one of the most fascinating, you know, sort of episodes of the 60s. Was, you know, in London, there were these two basically late teen call girls, Christine Keeler and Mandy Rice Davies, and who are really a testament to upward mobility in the most stratified society in the world, which was England, with its aristocracy. They were cute strippers in Soho who somehow got invited to the estate of Lord Astor, who had this house called Cliveden, was one of the great stately homes of England. And they caught the eye at this topless swimming party that they were invited to as the entertainment, or as the talent, of John Profumo, who was the British Secretary of War, was like their Secretary of Defense, one of the highest, you know, placed members of the British cabinet. Plus, he was married to Valerie Hobson, who was a famous British movie star. He was one of the most glamorous people in England. Anyway, he fell madly in love with Christine Keeler and started seeing her. But everybody who saw her fell madly in love with her, including another guy who was the Soviet military attaché. So she was in a very tricky love triangle in England with the Minister of War and the Soviet military attaché, who was the enemy. And also, she took trips to America, and she may have well seen John F. Kennedy, too, because one of the characters in the scandal was this guy named Tom Corbelly, who was a mystery man. He may have been working for the CIA, but he sort of was a Mr. Fix-It, who was based in Mayfair in London. He gave all the great parties and all, and he loved these girls, and he would introduce these girls around, and Kennedy never met a beautiful girl that he, like Bill Clinton, that he didn't have an eye for. And these girls made trips to America, so there may have been an even, which I talk about in Jet Set, that there may have been an American connection there as well. In any case, a huge scandal erupted. Profumo had to step down. His conservative government was dissolved. The Labour took power. England really changed. Stephen Ward, this osteopath who used to, you know, fix everybody, all of high society's backs, and he also was a portrait painter. He took their pictures. He was close to these girls, and he committed suicide. There was a movie years ago called Scandal in the 80s. It wasn't that great, but it did tell the story. But it's in Jet Set, and it's fun to read. And it was better than Elliot Spitzer and, you know, better than our sex scandal.
It's really not unlike the Monica Lewinsky scandal in that the government was affected by it and changed from it.
Well, Monica cost America probably more than Profumo cost England in terms of the impeachment. And
the election of George W. Bush.
Oh, my God. Let's not even think about that.
Well, it's a fascinating book, and it's called Jet Set, The People, The Planes, The Glamour and the Romance in Aviation's Glory Years. You guys out there in Radio Land will love it, and the author, William Stadium. Thanks so much for chatting with us on From the Bookshelf.
Thank you, Gary. It's a pleasure talking to you.
That's it for this week's From the Bookshelf. I hope you enjoyed the program and that you'll come back and see us again next week. In the meantime, you can subscribe to our podcast at iTunes. Find us on the web at fromthebookshelf.com. You can like us on Facebook. I want to thank my guest, William Stadium. His book is called Jet Set, The People, The Planes, The Glamour and the Romance in Aviation's Glory Years. From the Bookshelf is produced by Francis Venegas. I'm Gary Shapiro. See you next time.